In case anybody's forgotten, we are in the book of Genesis. So let's go ahead and open up there. Okay, Genesis chapter 10. So we're moving right along. Again, as we've noted before, you can kind of divide the first 11 chapters of Genesis, really focus on four key events: creation, the fall, the flood, and the dispersion at Babel. So we're moving right up to the dispersion at Babel here. Then the last chapters 12 through 50 chapters in Genesis, I think. Yeah, 12 through 50 focus on four key people: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So we're moving right along. Genesis chapter 10 begins, and we've talked about that before, those toledot divisions that we have in Genesis. Really, the book is organized around those, around 10 different toledots, and this is the fourth one. And that toledot is translated generations. And the emphasis, so in chapter 10, verse 1, these are the generations, the toledot of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And generations focuses on what follows. That doesn't necessarily mean the focus is on Shem and Ham and Japheth, but what follows from them is really the key focus in the toledot divisions. And what we have in chapter 10 is this horizontal genealogy that shows how the descendants of Noah spread out, populating the earth after the flood. And a lot of times you'll see people refer to chapter 10 as a table of nations. And when we get to chapter 11, those first nine verses, that'll finish out this fourth toledot. But that looks back to what caused the dispersion of the nations, and that'll be the judgment at Babel. We noted before that 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 4 through 23 has another genealogy that pretty much matches this one verbatim. Of course, it's written by Ezra 1,000 years or so after Moses records this one, so not a lot of change over a millennium. We can take confidence in the fact that these genealogies are indeed historical. We have the same record 1,000 years apart. And we looked at the descendants of Japheth last week, and the descendants of Japheth and Ham are treated first, saving Shem and his descendants till the end. And again, Noah had the four sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Shem is, of course, the messianic line. So Shem is going to be the last one dealt with in chapter 10. And then when we get over into chapter 11, after the tower incident at Babel, and starting in verse 10 of chapter 11, we'll have a more detailed genealogy of Shem that will take us all the way to Abraham, to Abram. So, and we noted before that that the names that we go through here, and Japheth was the shortest. So that was verse 2 through 5. And again, probably because the descendants of Japheth don't have much to do with Israel in the Old Testament timeline. Okay, the descendants of Ham are going to have a lot to do with Israel in the Old Testament timeline. And then the descendants of Shem the same way, since that is the messianic line. So Japheth dealt with pretty briefly. And again, we looked through that last week. But as we go through all these names, it's important to note that sometimes individuals are mentioned. Sometimes there's family or tribal names, and sometimes there's cities or locations. And sometimes it's hard to sort out exactly whether it's an individual or a city. And sometimes the cities are named after an individual. So there's some interplay in there. Sometimes the words are plural. Again, sometimes we're uncertain whether it's an individual or a city being mentioned. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that, we're 4,000 years now after the fact, and to sort everything out, after 4,000 years, it's not always possible to know exactly the geographical regions that are being referenced and the names that are being referenced. So we don't need to get discouraged if we don't know exactly where Dedan settled and all those kinds of things. But what we do want to understand is what the Bible has to say about these people. So, and also too, there is some supporting evidence in some ancient writings regarding some of these names that we come across. The Egyptian writings, Assyrian and Babylonian texts contain some of these names too, so they can help us place where some of these people ended up settling. And I'm kind of working on a map, so we can kind of look on a map to place things. So, and if there's a lot of good maps around when you look at the ancient Middle East about where these where all these people settled in verse 10. And verse 5 We'll start there again, just again finishing up the descendants of Japheth. From these descendants of Japheth, the coastlands of the nations were separated, into their lands, every one according to his tongue, according to their families, into their nations. So again, concludes the genealogy of the descendants of Noah through his son Japheth. And the Japhethites were very marine, coastland-oriented. And when we looked at this last time, we noted that they settled around the Mediterranean Sea and then up around the Black Sea and over to the Caspian Seas. Kind of when we're looking at the descendants of Japheth, I think it's good to think of an umbrella. It's like we have the, this is my map now, so like we have the Middle East here, and then we've got this umbrella of Japhethites to the kind of the northwest and the north and kind of the northeast. So they really expanded out outside of the area of the Middle East. And this really goes back to what we saw back in chapter 9, verse 27, where Noah is talking, you know, he's cursing Canaan, and then he's blessing Shem and Japheth, and he says, enlarge Japheth, you know, that Japheth would be enlarged. And that really relates to the extent of his coverage of the land. You know, the Japhethites, it's Europe and Asia and, you know, most of the land covered by the Japhethites. So, and then several key terms there in verse 5 to emphasize that theme of separation and dispersion. And again, we'll study that more when we get into chapter 11. Again, that's the judgment of God on mankind for not obeying his command to fill the earth, but rather they're going to be in one way, they want to be in one place. But that word lands is also translated territories. And that word tongue, if you have NASB, it's translated language. It's a literal tongue, but obviously a tongue is a language. And then families is also translated clans, and then and nations. So again, just this breakdown of how people are dispersed at this time. And we're going to see these same terms used, after we finish the genealogy of Ham, and also after we finish the genealogy of Shem in verse 20 and verse 31. Same words used, just in a different order. So the human race, although united by origin, okay, we're all from, we've talked about that. We are all of one blood, okay, originally through Adam and then kind of narrowed down back through Noah. So although the human race is united by origin, it's divided. In case you haven't noticed, this world is divided by language and territory and geopolitics and all those things. There's a lot of division. And all of that really flows out of the incident that we're going to cover in chapter 11, the dispersion at Babel. But again, this is all part of God's grand design for mankind. And we were here last week, but turn over to Acts chapter 17. Or you can just listen to me read it too. I think this really fits in well with what we're studying in Genesis. But Acts chapter 17, we have Paul on his, I believe this is his second missionary journey. Yeah, Paul's on his second missionary journey, and he's traveling around. He goes up into Europe, and he ends up at Athens. And in Athens, he's speaking to the people. And let's go down and pick up with, verse 22. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects." I like how Paul picks them up where they're at. They're pagan, heathen, you know, polytheists. So he picks them up where they're at. "For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship," verse 23, "I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" There were so many gods, they even had unknown gods that they worshipped. "Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." He's like, "I'm proclaiming to you that unknown God. There is a real God, and that's what I'm proclaiming to you. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things." Verse 26 is where I wanted to focus. "And he made from one man," okay, originally Adam, and then also through Noah, "every nation of mankind to inhabit all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation." So again, God's the one who's in control of setting up the nations of the earth. He takes full responsibility for that. So you know, the nations on earth. You know, I mean, we live in a very limited time frame here. We're in modern day America, good place to be, I think, in the overall scope of history. But the nations of the earth rise and fall, and they expand and they contract, you know, in accord with his sovereign workings. He's the one who's in control of how all this happens. You know, the nations may rage, but what does God do? You know, he laughs. It's like, yeah, they think they're so important. They think they're going to do this. And it's all in his control. Again, we see this starting, this genesis of the nations, back in Genesis chapter 10. So let's go back there. So beginning in verse 6, we'll pick up with the descendants of Noah through Ham. And again, Ham, significantly, we have a lot of details regarding the Hamites here. And again, Ham, the descendants of Ham, significantly impact the history of Israel and the Jewish people, and particularly his descendant Canaan, who we saw the curse on back in chapter 9. And again, the list of names here includes individuals, families, clans, cities, locations. So we can't always sort that out exactly. But let's pick up with verse 6. So the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. And just one thing, if you have the hat, I told you that I reserve the right to edit this thing because I just printed, I looked, you know, I just Googled free listing of the descendants of, because I didn't want to pay anything for it. So I reserved the Japhethites, that looked really good. On the Hamites, we're going to make a few changes there. One of them is the son Put. On the chart, he's spelled P-H-U-T, but that would be from the King James Version. So that would just be one discrepancy between what we read in LSB and NASB in most translations. It's a P-U-T, just a little bit of difference in how maybe you pronounce it. Instead of just Put, it might be Put. So that's kind of the difference. So no big deal. So we'll stick with Put and Canaan. So we have these four sons of Ham, and Cush and Mizraim and Canaan we're going to see some details of. This is the only time that Put is mentioned. So that the son Cush, if you have a Septuagint with you, it's translated Ethiopia. So there's pretty much a direct connection between Cush and Ethiopia. Ethiopia wouldn't be necessarily what we think of as modern Ethiopia, but it would be an extensive area south of Egypt. So Sudan, Ethiopia, those current African countries. And his descendants are going to be listed in verse 7 through 12. And one of his most infamous descendants is going to be Nimrod. So there's quite a bit of space devoted to Nimrod. So we'll look at that when we get down in verse 7 and following. And Mizraim is a transliteration of the Hebrew word for Egypt. So that is the Hebrew word for Egypt, is Mizraim. So that's where he settled, was in the area of Egypt. That's where his descendants generally settled as well. And we'll look at that in verse 13 and 14. And then again, Put, or P-H-U-T, if you have King James Version. This is the only time he's mentioned. So we really don't know much about him. If you have a Septuagint, translates it Libya. And that's a general thought that is this guy and his descendants are associated with modern Libya, west of Egypt. So again, just kind of where these people are panning out. And then Canaan. Of course, Canaan was the son, the grandson of Noah, the son of Ham that was cursed back in chapter 9, verse 25. And we'll talk about him. His descendants are listed in verse 15 through 19. So let's go on to verse 7. The sons of Cush, so we'll start with Cush, were Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Raamah and Sabtica. And the sons of Raamah were Sheba and Dedan. So I spent a long time working on the pronunciations. So that's one of those things that can get away from you a little bit. So if I pronounce them differently in different verses, yeah, it's okay. I mean the same thing. We can go by spelling. But again, for many of these, for the Cushites, which we noted before, that word Cush is translated in Septuagint and other translations as Ethiopia, kind of south of Egypt, that African area. A lot of his descendants, we're going to find, really migrated over to the Arabian Peninsula. So Cush, you know, started out in this Ethiopian area, but then his descendants seem to have migrated back up into the area of the Arabian Peninsula. So Seba, associated with the Sabaean people in the Arabian Desert. Havilah, also associated with Eastern Arabia near the shore of the Persian Gulf. Again, like I said, I'll put together a map. A lot of these aren't really dealt with elsewhere in Scripture, so they're not necessarily important. I think the main thing to pick up is God's got this detailed. He's got a plan, and he's setting things up. And then Sabta, same thing, unspecified. We don't really know from historical records necessarily real well or from biblical records where he settled, but probably in southern Arabia. Ra'amaz, also associated with southern Arabia, as are his sons, Sheba and Dedan. Some would say that the queen of Sheba would have come through this, but that's probably not likely because Seth is going to have a relative called Sheba as well. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to the descendants of Seth is probably where the queen of Sheba came. You know, she came up and visited with Solomon and all that in 1 Kings 10. But she probably didn't descend from this Sheba. So again, most of these in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Peninsula area, same with Sabtica. You know, doesn't deal a lot here with the descendants of Cush. But in verse 8, we are going to deal with one particular descendant of Cush, and that's Nimrod. That'll be his sixth son. Nimrod takes on a very distinguished tone as we read through this section. And I happened to run across an interesting article. This is what happens when you read too much. But in the 40s and 50s, Bugs Bunny sarcastically referred to Elmer Fudd as "you Nimrod." So since that time, Nimrod has taken on a very negative tone. Like if I came up and say, "Oh, Norm, you Nimrod," that's not a term of endearment. That's a term that implies "you moron, you dummy, you Nimrod." You know, that's it was taking on a very negative tone, and that all relates back to Bugs Bunny in the 40s and 50s. So we're going to see a little bit different tone associated with Nimrod as we work through this section of Scripture. So verse 8. Now Cush was the father of Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahweh. So a little bit different tone than what we might associate with the name Nimrod. But that mighty one is also translated valiant warrior or mighty warrior. Boyce noted that this was really the first major dictator and empire builder, you know, on the face of the earth. And that word mighty is repeated three times with reference to Nimrod. So he was an exceptional individual regarding his accomplishments. His hunting, normally that's going to refer to hunting animals, but there's also the thought here that he was hunting men in the sense to enslave them, that he was a real kind of tyrant type guy. One commentator noted, you know, he was a mighty warrior. He was, you know, a notable hunter. His name comes to be associated with, you know, a great hunter, that he may have been one who killed off the dinosaurs. You know, you can see him going up against a Tyrannosaurus Rex and trapping him or whatever. So that idea kind of floats around out there too. But again, his hunting prowess is proverbial in that day. We're told very clearly that statement before Yahweh doesn't express approval or disapproval of his actions. It's just this is what he was. He was a mighty hunter. Then verse 10 through 12 is going to continue to focus on Nimrod and the extent of the kingdom that he established. And this becomes real important because he establishes Babel, which is where the Tower of Babel happens in chapter 11. So let's pick up with verse 10. The beginning of his kingdom, again referring to Nimrod, was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. So the first use of the word kingdom, and kingdom carries the idea of sovereignty and domain. I mean, he's the one who's ruling is the idea. He's over things. And these initial four cities that he founded, you know, they're probably small villages to start with, and then they grow. And a Babel, again, the site of the tower incident when we get into chapter 11. That word Babel means to mingle, mix, and confuse. So it becomes very applicable to what happens in Babel. And it's usually translated Babylon. So when you see Babel, it's the same Hebrew word as Babylon. So then Eric is identified with the ancient capital of the Sumerian Empire. The Sumerian Empire, kind of important because it was like one of the first secular noted empires. You know, we find stuff from that empire in excavations and stuff. But the ancient Eric is probably the original city that later becomes known as Uruk, which is the capital of the Sumerian Empire. And that's located southeast of Babylon. And then Akkad, don't really know for sure where that site's at, but probably north of Babylon somewhere, became the capital of the Akkadian Empire, founded by Sargon the Great. There's a lot of history that you can read associated with this, but sometimes it just takes us too much off course to get too deep into some of that, I think. And then Kalna, not yet identified with certainty, but probably also somewhere near Babylon. That term land of Shinar refers to the central southern Mesopotamia. Kind of remember how the, give my map here. We'll get a better one together in the future. But, you know, the Tigris-Euphrates River kind of go through what we'd call Iraq today and then kind of go together and down into the Persian Gulf. Well, that's the general area of Mesopotamia, is that region between the Tigris on the north and the Euphrates on the south, those rivers. It's a very fertile plain. It makes sense. That's where kind of you start out these civilizations because you got good farmland, and so that makes perfect sense that that's where that would happen. But yeah, kind of that central southern part of Mesopotamia, again, that fertile plain between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, modern-day Iraq. And there's going to be a number of empires that rule this area, that are centered in this area. We talked about the Sumerian and the Akkadian, the Babylonians. You know, Hammurabi was the original Babylonian king, and then several centuries later along, you know, we had the Neo-Babylonian Empire with Nebuchadnezzar, and those all center in this area. The Assyrian Empire, again, a lot of these come to impact Israel immensely as time goes on. So again, some time being spent here on this descendant of Cush. Continue on with Nimrod as we get into verse 11. From that land, so from Shinar, he went out to Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth, Ur and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. So he expands his influence out of that area around Babylon and the southern Mesopotamia up to the north, and he establishes key cities there, and he's well known for his building projects. Remember who else was well known for their building projects? Cain, back in chapter 4, who murdered his brother Abel. So again, kind of that prideful thing. He's going to build all this stuff. But he builds Nineveh, which of course is the future capital of the Assyrian Empire, becomes a key city in biblical history. Again, that would be up to the north. Nineveh is really significant because it's very well known because of modern excavations, and they unearthed the Library of Ashurbanipal. It contains thousands of baked tablets, which, you know, proved invaluable in kind of reconstructing the history of this area of the world. So a lot of records from ancient Assyria in Nineveh. And then the next city mentioned there, Rehoboth-Ur, is really unexplained. Its name means broad places. So when you're reading commentators, some would say that it wasn't a separate city, but it was maybe a suburb of Nineveh. So again, there's no way to know. Calah is identified with the modern city of Nimrod, about 20, 30 miles south of Nineveh. And Rezin, somewhere between Nineveh and Calah, nothing else known. That concluding term, great city, is also translated principal city. Don't really know if that refers to Calah or to Rezin. The grammar's not necessarily super clear there, but it's kind of irrelevant in a way. So, and also too, I might want to mention just back on Nimrod, Micah chapter 5:6 refers to Assyria as the land of Nimrod. So again, kind of that connection centuries later, you know, millennia later, when we get up to the time of the prophet Micah. Okay, let's pick up with verse 13. Mizraim was the father of Ludim and Anamim and Leabim and Naphtahim and Pathrasim and Caslehim, from whom came the Philistines, and Kaphtorim. So a lot of those sound kind of the same. It's kind of like a rhyming thing. Don't try to say all of them twice in a row because your tongue will get tied. But so now we have the descendants of the fourth son, Mizraim. And that word, the M that follows all these is like an English S. It's a Hebrew plural. So again, we're talking about groups of people here that descend from an individual. And these really, all of these names are associated with Africa. So Mizraim, you know, the transliteration for the word Egypt, you know, the Hebrew word for Egypt, and all of his family sticks kind of around in that area. So let's pick up with Ludum, probably the African tribes west of the Nile Delta. So that would be west of Egypt. And Anamim, probably the North Africa area west of Egypt as well, likely over in Libya. Layabim, probably Libya. Naphtuim, probably the Nile Delta region. Pathrusim would be the people of Pathros, which is an area of southern Egypt. Kasluhim, the location's not known. But the Philistines, who of course become a key figure in Old Testament history, descend from this group. And the King James translates that Philistim, and that's what's on the chart. So they tend to stick with King James version terminology on this. But this is a group, not a name of an individual. And then the Kaphtorim resided in Crete. And that's Greece, or Crete is called Kaphtorim in history, so we can identify that pretty well. Amos chapter 9, verse 7, and Jeremiah chapter 47, verse 4, as well as extra-biblical sources, say that the Philistines were from Kaphtor, where the Kaphtorim are, which is Crete. But here we have that they're associated with the Kasluhim. So some people bring up, oh, there's a conflict there. Well, are they from Crete or are they from the Kasluhim? Well, you know, there's some explanations for that. You know, I hope I'm not getting too much into the weeds, but it's kind of fun to read through some of this stuff. But the Kasluhim and Kaphtorim were closely related groups. You know, maybe the Philistines, maybe there was some intermarriage. So again, the Kasluhim were in Egypt, and then the Kaphtorim were over on Crete. And maybe they got together, maybe they intermarried. So maybe the Philistines came from both, would be a possibility. Or maybe the Philistines originally came from Kaphtor, from Crete, but were ethnically descendants of Mizraim through Kasluhim. So there's just lots of ways to explain this, whether you're talking about geographic or genealogy. That's not a killer. You know, some people, critics would say, oh, your Bible's not right, look. It's like, you know, you better focus on something different. This isn't a problem at all. Okay, let's keep on going. We're getting close. verse 15. Canaan was the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite. And these are all names that we, you know, come to be used of the land of Canaan. And the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. And afterwards, the families of the Canaanite were scattered. So here we have all those descendants of Canaan. Again, they become very critical in Israel's history, so there's a lot of attention to them here. Sidon, obviously, probably the founder of the, you know, the major Phoenician city of Sidon. Heth. And if you have NIV, it translates it Hittites, but there's probably not a connection between this Heth and then the Hittites, which are a major empire a little further to the north. Jebusites, you know, they're very familiar inhabitants of Jerusalem before David conquered it and made it his capital. And you can see, read about the Jebusites in Exodus 3, Joshua 12, Judges 1, and then 2 Samuel chapter 5. The Amorites occupied the hill country of Judah. We'll read about them when we get up to Abraham in Genesis chapter 14, but they peacefully coexist with Abraham, and they participate. Remember when Abraham kind of leads this coalition to defeat the eastern kings, the Amorites join in with that, so they kind of ally with Abraham there. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 15. And while we're talking about the Amorites. Oops. I Genesis chapter 15. And go down to verse 12. And here we have God talking to Abraham. Now it happened that when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Then God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your seed will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs," of course predicting the Egyptian bondage. "And they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will also judge the nation to whom they are enslaved, and afterwards they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age." Okay, so this is going to happen in the future. You don't have to worry about it, Abram. You're going to be dead by the time all this problem happens. That's my paraphrase. So then verse 16 is where I wanted to go. "Then in the fourth generation, they, your descendants, will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." So again, here this referring to the Amorites in this prophecy and this revelation from God in Genesis chapter 15. So God tells Abram that his descendants will return to the land after four generations. You know, once the sin of the Amorites is complete, means reaches its full measure. So it'll be time for judgment on the Amorites, and that's when he's going to bring Israel to the land to defeat the Amorites, because their sin will be fulfilled at that time. So again, just God using nations to judge other nations and just how he controls everything that happens. There's an absolute purpose in everything that happens. And then the Girgashites, we don't know much about. The Hivites, not mentioned outside of the Bible. The Arkites, according to they are in extra biblical writings. Josephus writes about them. They live in that general area of Lebanon. The Sinites, probably located somewhere nearby, and the Arvidites, well attested in Near Eastern texts. They lived on the Phoenician island city of Arvad. So again, all along that eastern Mediterranean border. The Zemarites, on our chart, the Zemarite is translated Temerite, and there's no reason to do that, so I don't know if whoever wrote the chart, it's an error, but I couldn't find any translations that use Temerite instead of Zemarite, so a small error on that. You can correct that on your chart. And then the Hamathites probably founded the city of Hamath in ancient Syria. That would be the northernmost border of the land of Canaan. So, and then the end of verse 18, and the families of the Canaanite were scattered. So a special attention, you know, to these descendants of Canaan, due to their impact on Israel and the Jews, you know, in Moses' day. Remember, Moses is writing this, and he's writing it as the Israelites are getting ready to, you know, through the 40 years of wilderness wandering, they're going to invade the land, and guess who they're going to run into? These are the people they're going to run into, are the Canaanites. So now everybody knows where they came from. Again, that word scattered refers to the event at the tower that we'll read about in 2 weeks. That word scattered is also translated spread abroad. If you have NASB, it's used in chapter 11 in verse 4, verse 8, and verse 9. Verse 5, we saw the word separated. We're going to see that word separated in chapter 10, verse 32. So in case you don't pick up on a reoccurring theme here, it's dispersion, scattered, spread abroad, separated. Again, God's judgment on the people. So we'll go ahead and stop there, and we'll finish out. Next week, we'll go through, I'm going to stop here for just a few minutes. Verse 19 kind of finishes out the Canaanites, but I want to talk just a little bit about their borders. So we'll save that till next week. And then verse 20, I'll conclude the genealogy of the descendants of Noah through his youngest son, Ham. And then we'll pick up with the descendants of Shem to finish out the chapter. So we have a couple of minutes if anybody has any questions or comments that they'd like to bring up or ask. As long as it's not a pronunciation-related one.
Well, in the last days, Japheth's descendants, Gomer and Magog, Meshach, attack Israel.
Yeah, that's all. Those names are referenced in the Revelation prophecies and in the Ezekiel prophecies, and those are very familiar names in other biblical prophecies. So. But yeah, that would be kind of future. As far as ancient Israel goes, not a lot of connection, not a lot of occurrence of Japhethites in in the record. So, but yeah, good. Anything else? Okay, yeah.
How tall was the clock tower of Babel?
We'll get to that in 2 weeks. So, sorry. Yeah, I think very tall. I mean, most people can't figure out how they could build a tower that big without caterpillars and modern construction equipment. So, but yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit when we get there. And also about the population of the world at that time when we get there. So, okay. All right, well, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for your word and just so much, Father, for the confidence we have as we see how you've controlled everything from the beginning of history, how everything's moving according to your perfect plan and time. And we just pray, Father, for the part that we play in your plans. Help us, Father, to focus on our responsibilities and our responsibilities to know your word, our responsibilities to pray to you and to live holy lives, our responsibility to share the truth of the gospel with those around us. Just help us, Father, to stay focused on those core things that we might be pleasing to you in everything we do. We do pray for the sermon to follow. Just ask again, Father, that we'd become more and more like Jesus as we hear and understand and live out your word. In Jesus' name, amen.